We do have a quorum. Senator Hoffman, first we will move the minutes from the last meeting, if you're amenable to doing that. So Senator Hoffman moves the minutes from the Monday, March 10th meeting. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes are adopted. Senator Hoffman, the bill before us today is Senate File 2401, Elections Data Sharing Authorization.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And, you know, I feel like a ping pong ball, you know. You're just running. These are really busy days, so I appreciate this time. Thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 2401, known by many as the ERIC, the Electronic Registration Information Center bill. And at this time, I'd like to offer an author's amendment, Madam Chair. It's the A1, and it's to get the language, the bill in the language that's ready for this committee. So is that being passed?
Senator Hoffman, I believe it's the A2 amendment now.
My bad. Thank you, Madam Chair. The A2 amendment.
It's in members' packet. This will get the shape in the bill Senator Hoffman would like. All those in favor of the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A2 is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with me at the table today is John Lindbeck, who is the Executive Director of ERIC, the Electronic Registration Information Center, and Beth Frazier, of course, from the Secretary of State's office. And members, you know, Minnesota has a great voting system, and we also know we can improve it and be made more efficient, save time and money. And in order to increase both the efficiency and the integrity of Minnesota elections, I want to carry this bill that allows Minnesota to participate in data-sharing program that is controlled and governed by those states that choose to participate in it. And I'm just going to give a little background. In 2012, a consortium of states consisting of both Democratic and Republican secretaries of state created ERIC, the Electronic Registration Information Center. And it was created because states recognized that the data on America's voter rolls contained significant amounts of out-of-date and inaccurate information. And as a result of these issues, the states created ERIC with the sole mission of assisting in improving the integrity of America's voter rolls and increasing access to voter registration for all eligible citizens. And now we live in a mobile society, and we know that it takes a concerted effort among the states to ensure that our voter rolls are accurate. Using ERIC Data Center would allow Minnesota to safely and securely compare the voter data against Minnesota's own DVS data, the Social Security Death Index, and against other states' voters and the DMV data. In addition to the laudable goals of ERIC, I want to give you some specifics of why Minnesota should participate in ERIC now. Currently, Minnesota cannot use Social Security Death Index to identify deceased voters on our voter rolls because the Social Security Administration no longer provides last state of residence in the data. And it's that vote early and often comment there. ERIC would allow Minnesota to remove deceased voters from the rolls, and having deceased voters appear on the rolls is not only inaccurate, but it decreases the voter confidence when they see somebody on the rolls that they know has died. And currently, despite county officials' best efforts, Minnesota voter rolls contain duplicates. ERIC would allow Minnesota to identify these duplicates and remove them from the list. Again, this would increase the accuracy and the voter confidence. Currently, 70% of Minnesotans who use same-day registration at polls on Election Day use a current valid driver's license. ERIC would allow us to reduce this number by identifying voters that need to update their registration prior to Election Day. We know that same-day registration provides an important service to voters, but it also increases the time spent by all voters at the polls and the time spent by counties processing data after Election Day. Finally, currently, many of Minnesotans' otherwise eligible voters are not registered, and they wait until Election Day to register. ERIC would allow us to identify those potentially eligible voters and provide information to them on how to register. The bill before us would permit Minnesota to address all those issues. This bill would allow Minnesota to join both the conservative and liberal states that are already using the ERIC technology to ensure accuracy and integrity voter rolls and to provide outreach to eligible but unregistered voters. With that, I'm going to turn this over to John Lindbeck, who is the Executive Director of ERIC, and he will explain more about how ERIC works.
Mr. Lindback, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm John Lindback. I am the Executive Director of the Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC. ERIC is a fairly new organization in that it was first formed in May 2012. I was brought on in January of this year. It now has two employees, and we service the states that are members. The mission of ERIC is to improve the accuracy of voter rolls, reduce costs, and improve efficiency for state and local election offices. We were recently endorsed by the President's Commission on Elections Administration. That was the group that was appointed and chaired by the head, the chief lawyer for the Romney campaign, Ben Ginsburg, and the chief lawyer for the Obama campaign, Bob Bauer. And he asked them to look at the issues related to the 2012 presidential election, how to reduce lines and so forth. And ERIC was prominently mentioned in that report as a recommendation to the states that states ought to be participating in data matching and data sharing with each other and data matching of whatever available databases they have within their own states with that goal of making their voter registration lists more accurate. And a more accurate list means shorter lines on election day and provides a number of other benefits as well. So the goal is to balance accuracy and access, as Senator Hoffman just mentioned. We do know that there are 1.8 million deceased individuals who are listed as voters now in America's voter rolls. So Minnesota is not alone in this issue. We do know nationally that there are 2.7 million voters registered in multiple states, and we do know that there are 12.7 million records that are out of date in America's voters rolls at any time, and those are people. The great majority of those people are people who have moved and have not updated their voter registration after they've moved. And we also know that there are 51 million Americans that are not registered to vote. And so ERIC attempts to address all of those issues. So it attempts to better identify voters who have died, and the states get reports. We use the matching process to do that, to find and reconcile duplicates, to keep up with the mobile electorate, and target voter registration when people move. So the reports that the states, well, first of all, let me talk about the organization itself. It's completely state-run. There's a board of directors. Each member state has a director on the board. It was incorporated in 2012. There is a membership agreement that's available on the ERIC website, which is ericstates.org. There are now employees in place. The states that are participating are routinely uploading their data and getting reports back. It's a continuous process where the states upload their data every 60 days and receive reports back. And, of course, we're doing our best to recruit new members to increase the size of the organization. These are the current members: Washington, Oregon, Nevada, Utah, and Colorado in the West, Virginia, Maryland, D.C., Delaware in the West, in the East, excuse me. And so we're looking at a number of states that have passed legislation who we expect to be joining shortly. That includes Ohio, North Carolina, South Carolina. Arizona has also passed legislation, though I think it will be a longer term before they join. Other states are working on legislation very diligently, just like you are here in Minnesota. That includes Illinois. Other states are expressing interest in other ways. So there's definitely a buzz on about ERIC. The states know about it. States want to join, and the process is beginning where the organization will be getting larger. So the ERIC reports that the states receive, by matching your voter registration list against your in-state DMV list, we can issue each state a report on what we call in-state movers. Those are people that have a more recent address on file with the DMV than they do with the elections folks. We also issue them a report on cross-state movers, those people that move from one state to another ERIC state, and I'll give you the numbers on how that's turning out in just a second. By matching against the Social Security Death Index, the ERIC is able to provide states with reports of deceased people still on the rolls. And it looks within each state database, voter registration database, to provide a report on in-state duplicates. And then again, going back to that match with the DMV list, people who are on the state's DMV list but are not registered to vote and are potentially eligible, the state receives a report on that as well. So the February 2014 report statistics, here are the numbers that we've we're looking at so far in terms of voters or individuals who have moved or are not registered to vote. In-state movers, we've reported just shy of 1.3 million to the participating states. And that has turned out to be, those reports are the biggest reports. And as a former elections official myself, I was surprised by that. And I think this gives adequate and sort of compelling reason why, even if you didn't do any of the cross-state matching, why it would be worth it to join ERIC, because it does such an effective job of telling you which of your in-state voters have a more recent address with the DMV.
Mr. Limbeck, can you explain what, and I understand that those are aggregate numbers from across the country,
right,
but what are we not doing in Minnesota where we would benefit from getting this information? So
you're not now matching your voter registration list against your DMV list using the most sophisticated matching software available, which is what you would get if you joined ERIC.
So, and perhaps this is for Ms. Frazier, but right now we are doing this, but the explanation is that this would be a more sophisticated tool to do it, or ability to do it, or?
Madam Chair and members, Beth Frazier, Deputy Secretary of State. We are currently using the driver's license list to verify new registrants as they register or when people update their registrations. And when people get their driver's license, they have the option of checking a box and saying that they want to register to vote. But we are not regularly cross-checking the two lists otherwise. And so, for example, if somebody updates their driver's license and does not check the box to update their registration, we do not receive notice of that. So what that means is that people are updating their driver's licenses, not their voter registrations, and then what we find is 70% of same-day registrants use an updated driver's license. So if instead we were getting that information ahead of time, a huge portion of those people could be pre-registered to vote, which would mean shorter lines in the polling places, less time for voters on election day, less work for local election officials after the fact, and better data for candidates and other groups that are trying to do outreach to voters.
I understand that explanation. I'm just wondering why you can't cross-check those lists yourselves now.
Madam Chair, we do not have the authority to cross-check that list. Number one. Secondly, we don't have the program written to cross-check the list. And so, Eric,
you can't do that yourself.
Madam Chair, we could do that ourselves. I don't know how much it would cost for us to do that programming.
Okay. Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. Thank you. I'll go on to the cross-state movers. The data is all matched, so you get a report on people in your state that have moved out of state to the other ERIC states, and you get a report on that. There are about 228,000 so far. In terms of matching against the Social Security Death Index, ERIC has reported 47,263 deceased individuals on the lists of the current ERIC states. I have to sort of brag a bit about the software used by ERIC, which was developed by IBM and is indeed the most sophisticated matching technology available. And The state of Washington used to match on its own with the Social Security Death Index. And by using a more sophisticated brand of software that allows for more name variations, transposition and slight differences in numbers, and is able to connect those dots and make those matches anyway, the state of Washington was able to find thousands of deceased people on their list that they were not able to catch on their own. I am absolutely confident that other states are, that a state like Minnesota would experience the same thing. And then in-state duplicates. So those are just duplicate registrations within a state's voter registration database. The final reports on a separate slide here is the eligible but unregistered. Those are the people with that are in a state's DMV database that are not on the voter registration database, and we reported 6.1 million names to the current ERIC states on that list. Now, here's something that's more Minnesota-specific, and that is one of the this sort of illustrates for you the reason why ERIC would be valuable to you in its matching against the death index. And if you see in column one there, there's voter one, which is a name off the voter registration list. There's no last four digits of the Social Security number. If you look at this, the DMV list, that individual shows up again. Again, no last four digits of the Social Security number. But if you look at the Social Security death index there out in the end, you get that last four digits, and you're able to make that connection that this person is in fact a deceased individual. Minnesota does not have those last four digits in its current voter registration database. Is that correct, Beth?
Madam Chair, Mr. Lindbeck, Minnesota has collected the last four digits of Social Security numbers from voters who provided them since 2004, but for the vast majority of voters, we do not have the last four digits. And so we are not able to use them for matching with the death index for most voters.
Okay, thanks for that clarification. So this is something Minnesota specific where you would get a benefit from joining. The last thing I'd like to mention is that from the beginning, when ERIC was being planned, privacy and security advocates were brought into the planning process and helped us design ERIC. It involves a variety of both privacy and security features. And we had it evaluated, the plan evaluated by the Center for Democracy and Technology, which is the leading advocacy organization in this country on those issues. And you can see by the quotation here on the screen from their report that they gave ERIC their blessing as having done everything it can possibly do to provide privacy and security to the data. And steps that are in actually beyond what current states are doing to protect their own data. So I'll leave that at here for questions and follow-up. And, of course, I'm available by email and phone and all that kind of good stuff.
And thank you.
My number's on the last screen.
Questions for Mr. Lindbeck from the committee. Ms. Frazier, is there more you wanted to add?
Madam Chair and members, we just think that it would be beneficial for Minnesota to join this consortium, that we could help reduce the number of same-day registrants by getting notification that folks have moved before Election Day if they've updated their driver's license record. And it would allow us to use the Social Security death information. My understanding is that driver's license records in Minnesota do include the last four digits of individual Social Security numbers. And so it would allow us to use that information and remove people who have died from the voter rolls.
And Ms. Frazier, Mr. Lindbeck, can you comment on how Minnesota would be one of the first states in the upper Midwest? So what are we not gaining by having more neighbor states join this or use this technology?
Madam Chair, there's no doubt that had, you know, if you joined first in the upper Midwest and not about the same time as other states, that the number of cross-state matches will not be as, you know, that volume of those will be lower for you than if your neighboring states were there. But there are states, at least in the region, who are very seriously looking at ERIC and will join, including Illinois and Iowa. So I can speak with some confidence that you won't be far behind. They won't be far behind you if you join sooner than them.
And this is not the budget division of elections. That there's a fiscal note that's been requested. We don't have that yet. That will come to when the bill goes to the finance division. But can you just comment on, is this a one-time request for money, or is there an ongoing contract that the state will pay as long as it's in it? And Ms. Frazier, is this something where, if you're comfortable saying now, I see that it's coming from the general fund, so it's not something you're looking to absorb within the secretary's office, the costs?
Madam Chair and members, the cost would come from the general fund. The costs in the first year are substantially greater than costs in subsequent years. There is an initiation fee or joining fee to join ERIC at $25,000. And then there are dues each year, and the dues will go down as more states join. My understanding is at this point they're about $50,000 per year. The other cost for the state is the mailing to voters who are identified as eligible but not registered. And that will be largest in the first year, and then after that will be substantially smaller, because once we've mailed to these folks once, there's not a requirement to mail to them again. So each year folks will be identified, but the number will be substantially smaller.
And Ms. Frazier, are the local election officials supportive of this? I just see that they're going to be required to conform their data to match this system. Are they supportive?
Madam Chair and members, I haven't had lengthy discussions with the local election officials. I would expect them to be fully supportive, because I think it will actually save them money. By reducing the need for as many election judges to process same-day registrations and workers after Election Day, again, to process same-day registrations. The good news is that the way that the ERIC provides the report to the Secretary's office will not require reprogramming of the statewide voter registration system, because we do have a process set up for information on deceased voters. And so the report from ERIC will flow right into that. We do have a queue set up for people who have moved within the state or outside of the state. And so there is not additional programming needed, and the data will be queued for the counties and very easy for them to process.
Okay, thank you. Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify on Senate File 2401? Please approach the podium, Mr. McGrath. Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Dan McGrath, President of Minnesota Majority. I've done a fair bit of research into this ERIC system and how Minnesota could benefit from it. I'm looking at it entirely from an election integrity perspective, and I find that the system looks like a good idea for Minnesota because of two key benefits. First, the elimination of deceased voters from our voter rolls, which Minnesota Majority's research in the past has indicated there are thousands remaining on the voter rolls that shouldn't be, for whatever reason. Secondly, the state-to-state match, which is rather limited right now because there are a few states participating in the program. Once it expands, it's got great potential to prevent duplicate voter registrations from state to state. One criticism that I have of it is not designed to look for people that voted in more than one state, but it will help us to clean the voter rolls of people that have moved out of the state to prevent that security hole in our election system remaining on the voter rolls. So that's all I have to say about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, Senator Hoffman moves that Senate File 2401 as
Madam Chair.
Excuse me. Senator Newman.
I just got two quick questions, if I could. Page 2 down at the bottom, it talks in terms of, on line 33, the Secretary of State can enter into agreements with groups of states to exchange information. Could you explain, and this could be any of the testifiers or Senator mm-hmm. Hoffman, explain to me whether there's any danger to the folks in the state of Minnesota, our citizens, where we're going to be sharing information, their private data, with other states. And I'm thinking in terms of there has been a number of data security breaches within the state of Minnesota alone in the last, say, year. And now we are talking about sharing that data with other states. And I'm just wondering if Mississippi or Louisiana or joins Eric, I mean, how secure is our data going to be?
Mr. Limbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Newman. Thank you for asking that question, because I love to talk about the privacy and security part of this. We talk about data sharing because we have to word it that way. But one of the features of ERIC is that the data that is considered confidential within a state and within the participating states, that's the last four digits of the Social Security number, date of birth, is anonymized, what we call anonymized, before it leaves state control. And the screen sort of gives you an example of that. Each participating state is issued an anonymization program once they become a member. And before the data is transferred to ERIC, those fields that need to be anonymized are run through the anonymizer, and they're translated into a big, long string of numbers and letters, as you see on the screen there. And then when it gets matched against another state, Beth, if you could click it again, it's matched against other anonymized data. And so the reports you get back then tell you there's a match in the other state, but you don't need to know what that date of birth was or what those last four digits of the Social Security number were. All you need to know is that it was a match, and that's the way the report reads. There's a match because you don't know what the number was. But through the anonymization process, that information is kept private before it ever leaves the state's control. I had a lot of trouble sort of wrapping my mind around this, and so I sort of like to use this analogy of a pig, a meat grinder, and the sausage. you take the pig, you put it through the grinder, and out comes sausage, and you can't turn the sausage back into the pig once you've already gone through that process, and that's essentially the same with the anonymization. So this was advised by the privacy and security folks who helped us form ERIC, and as a measure that you can take that absolutely minimizes your risk of any kind of disclosure to the greatest extent possible.
Thank you, Mr. Limbeck. Madam Chair, one final question. Senator Hoffman, on page 3, beginning at line 3.7, there's an appropriation that you are proposing for this bill. On the online voter registration bill that we heard a couple of days ago, I had proposed that we also, in that instance, appropriate money to the Secretary of State for that bill. In your mind, Senator Hoffman, what's the difference? Why are we appropriating money in this bill to the Secretary of State, but not in online voter registration?
Senator Newman, with all due respect, I think that is a somewhat fair question. The question of the appropriation and the amount is really best left to the division in which the appropriation will be discussed. As you'll see, the appropriation amount is blank in here, and what's before our committee now is whether we think that the policy of enacting this is a good idea. I did, obviously it's important to keep in mind how much things would cost, but I don't think it's necessarily fair to compare or to ask Senator Hoffman to compare an appropriation for this bill to an appropriation for a previous bill that we've heard in a previous committee.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate your comments. I respectfully disagree. I'm not asking of Senator Hoffman the amount that he is proposing be appropriated. I'm asking more from a standpoint of a policy consideration. Why would we appropriate money on one bill that is going to the Secretary of State but not to the other? So that was the purpose of my question. If Senator Hoffman doesn't think it's a fair question or doesn't want to answer it, it's fine with me.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Newman, you know, it's the leverage question that, you know, I'm sure the finance people probably forget more in a day than I'll ever know, you know, regarding balancing a checkbook, whether it comes from the general fund or it's appropriated. I don't know the outcome to that, Senator Newman, although it is a great question. I was just talking with Ms. Frazier about it, you know, the difference between the general fund versus getting the money actually into the Secretary of State. I'd be willing to try to understand the end game on that one, Senator Newman, but by all means, you know, let's pass this policy bill and then move it on to get to the financial folks talking about what's right. And I know Senator Cohen's got his finger up.
Senator Cohen. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill looks like it has some promise, but I do have some concerns, and so checking into it a little bit more here. I just have a few questions, though. What does the Secretary of State Office currently pay for NCOA or for matching death records or other kinds of work that you do that it appears as though Eric would mean that would be unnecessary? So what are you currently spending in this area?
Ms. Frazier.
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, the Secretary's office is currently paying about $10,000 a year for the National Change of Address data matching, about $2,000 a year for the Social Security Administration data matching.
And Ms. Frazier, would those costs continue, or would that be replaced by this system?
Madam Chair, those costs would be replaced by the system.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I think the other thing is best left for a finance committee, just some of the things that just kind of work. The other one is on a policy thing, and that is on line 2.10. I'm just curious as to why it says, for addresses for which the Secretary of State is unable to determine the precinct, the Secretary may forward information to county auditors for individual review. It was odd to see a may in there. Is there a reason for the may? Because the normal course would be to automatically send it to them because they often have more detailed local information on addresses or precincts.
Ms. Frazier.
Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, the current law does not allow us to forward information to counties if we cannot determine the precinct. And what we found with the National Change of Address data is that the precinct finder, as you know, has address ranges designated by the counties. So Hennepin County, for example, may call Broadway Avenue Highway 7. And if it comes through as Broadway Avenue, then it doesn't match. And so, therefore, at this point, that data is not forwarded onto the counties because it does not match the precinct finder. What this language would allow us to do is, if we can determine the county, allow us to forward it. But if we are completely unsure which county it goes to, this allows us to not forward information.
Well, Madam Chair, then
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Okay, you still have a voter who is attempting to register. Does something happen with that at all, or is there a queue anywhere that kind of puts them in a we're not quite sure, or maybe Eric could be helpful there?
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, this is not for a voter who is attempting to register. This has to do with data matching related to the national change of address updates. So it's people who have indicated that they're moving and whether we can determine to where they are moving.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just concerned that we leave no voter hung up in a system unaddressed to which every effort is made. So that's my questions for now, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Senator Kiffmeyer, you'll see in the lines in existing law, mm-hmm. right before it, if they can locate the precinct, then they must transmit the information to the county. Okay. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify or any other discussion? Seeing none, Senator Hoffman moves that Senate File 2401 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Both opposed.
The motion passes, and that is the motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Ress, Senate File 1082. Senator Rest, Senate File 1082. Proposed
thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I do have a delete all amendment, but this is not the Committee of Original Jurisdiction, so I would like to move the amendment and then explain it before I would ask the subcommittee to take action on it. And it is the A9 amendment.
Members, the delete all A9 amendment is being distributed now. To that amendment, Senator Rest.
Thank you very much. Before I want members to have it in front of them, but before I do go through it, just by way of introduction of this proposal, I think that all of us can agree that Minnesota has a premier system of justice among the states. We have a judiciary that I believe, and I think most Minnesotans believe, is laudable in the way in which it conducts itself, the way in which it holds itself accountable, and in the fairness of the decisions that it renders, whether it be at the workers' compensation courts, which is covered by this bill, the district courts throughout the state of Minnesota, the appellate court, and indeed the Supreme Court. I believe that our system is without peer. What the bill is addressing is the way in which we can preserve and, I would say, enhance the ability of our justice system to continue in the fine tradition that has been established since the beginning of our existence as a state. So to that, I would direct your attention to the A9 amendment, and I will go through it section by section. The bill comes to you from the Judiciary Committee from last year, which had it and passed it to the Rules Committee, which has sent it to the Elections Committee. And there has been a great deal of discussion and attention paid to language. Language in the law is extremely important. And so we have been going over it and over it and over it to make sure that we make sure that the proposal is as clear and transparent as we can make it, that it serves the purposes for which we want the statute to and the Constitution to reflect, and in meeting with people who are interested in the election of judges, that we take into account their concerns and considerations and suggestions for improvement. So The bill is divided into two articles. The first article has to do with what change would occur in the Constitution if the voters approve the constitutional language that is offered in section 2. It is Article 6 of the Minnesota's Constitution that actually it's not a very long article, but it deals with the third branch of government in Minnesota, that of the judiciary. It would provide for two changes in the constitutional language that would reflect a system of the judiciary, which would call for a constitutionally required merit selection process with the governor appointing judges following a process of merit selection, a period of review for judges and justices, and then their retention in office being accomplished through a retention election. That is what is provided for in Section 1 of the bill in terms of the changes that are made in Section 7, Sections and 8 of the Constitution. The Section 2 of the bill is the question that would be submitted to the voters. I would also point out that as we have dealt with the progression of this bill, at some points, although there has the performance evaluation group commission has been put into the constitutional issues and in the question, that there was discussion along the way about whether merit selection, which is currently a discretionary process in the statutes, ought to be constitutionally dedicated. And we have come over the course of the years to, in a discussion about this proposal, to believe in the merits, if you will, of having a constitutionally established merit selection commission to which the governor must be responsive. So the second question two, or section two, rather, is the question that would be put to the voters, and it has also undergone a great deal of study and comment, and it involves all of the elements that that would happen, that need to happen, that need to be before the voters in order to accomplish the change in the Constitution that would be in Articles 6, Sections 7 and 8. So the question is, shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended to establish an independent public performance evaluation commission that will empower voters with nonpartisan information about the performance of justices and judges? And by the way, with regard to, we have these twin terms throughout the statute, because we refer to the members of the appellate courts and the Supreme Court as justices, and to members of the district courts and the workers' compensation courts as judges. Rather than coming to a definition of putting judge in that would include justice, we decided that it would be more reflective of our tradition to always include both words. And at the end of the bill, you'll see that we have an instruction to the reviser to do the same throughout the statutes. Furthering on the question to restore accountability to voters through judicial retention elections, as well as enhance, protect, and ensure the quality, impartiality, and integrity of our courts by requiring merit selection for all justices and and judges. On page 2, there is title that is suggested for the, which is required and suggested for the question that would be put to the voters. And as you recall, there's been with two, notably with a couple of amendments in the past few years, the Secretary of State asserted authority to put a title on the questions that were submitted to the voters, and the court denied that authority and left it to the legislature. And so we, in this bill, are providing that same, doing that same thing, and the title of it would be Impartial Election of Judges, Requiring Merit Selection and Public Performance Evaluation of Judges. In that one instance, we have not said justices and judges. Part of the thing about a title of a constitutional amendment is trying to capture the essence of what the people are being asked in as short of phrases as possible. So in this instance, we have not said justices and judges, but just judges. In Section 3 of Article 1, we provide for a transition period from the current system of contested elections, a discretionary merit selection process, and no regularized evaluation, performance evaluation of judges from that system and to the system that would be in place or come into being if the constitutional question was approved. The Article 2 is the statutory provisions that would need to be changed if the voters approved the question, which, of course, again, is 50% or majority, 50% plus one of all those voting in the election, not 50% plus one voting on this question. Some of the provisions that you see in Article 2 are updating the statutes with regard to the election of judges or justices, but that reflect mostly the changes that we made in the campaign finance law in 2013, rather than imposing or bringing about a new change in the campaign finance law with regard to judges or justices. In Section 1, we specify that a ballot question does not include a judicial retention election. Why do that? Well, as you know, on ballot questions, on constitutional amendment questions, you vote yes or no. And we want to make sure that simply because you're voting yes or no about whether a judge or justice should be retained, that does not make it a term of art relative to it being a ballot question. In Section 2, we define or we extend the word candidate to include a person who is up, a judge or a justice that's up for retention in a judicial office. In Section 3, we include or extend again the term election to include not just a primary, special primary, general or special election, but also the retention election. Section 4 is a campaign finance change, and so it's coming out of Chapter 10A, and is just references a registration of a first registration of a committee with regard to a retention election that voters will have before them, and is reflects changes that were made last year. You may recall that we had an expenditure level previously in law of $100, and last year we moved it to $750 before someone was required to to take any action with registration. Section 5 also reflects necessary changes in the, if you look at 318, in the changes that were made in 2013, and that is part of this bill. And part of the reason for a delete everything amendment is to when we first introduced this bill, of course, we had not passed a 2013 campaign finance bill. And so in order to not have a really, really messy page and line amendment, we did a delete all so that the 2013 changes could be reflected in a reasonable way in front of us. In Section 6, we simply add justice or judge with regard to the as a candidate for office for a retention election. The Section 7 is the notice that must be given for someone who has filed for election. Section 8 indicates that the official ballot that Minnesota voters receive will contain the names of all justices or judges seeking to retain their offices. Currently, as you may know, a great majority of judges who run for re-election in a non-contested basis. Those elections are often ignored by voters, which is probably doesn't say very much about us as voters, but that we ignore them. But I'm certainly sure that none of you ignore them, and I certainly don't. But what is on the ballot right now with regard to a judge is the designation that whether he or she is an incumbent. And that designation is there in a contested race. So if Judge Hoffman is the incumbent and candidate Sieben wants to run against Judge Hoffman's seat on, you know, in District 13 or whatever of the Hennepin County bench, the Judge Hoffman by his name will have the word incumbent. That would no longer be necessary because we would be voting only on the merits of Judge Hoffman's performance evaluated by a nonpartisan commission, and we would be voting yes or no. So one of the repealers in the bill is indeed taking away the word incumbent next to a judge's name. In Section 9, it is the provisions for filing an affidavit of candidacy with the Secretary of State. When we start talking about the performance evaluations, if a judge decides that they're not going to seek election under the retention election system for people to vote on, they need not go through the performance evaluation process, but also they would be prohibited from filing an affidavit of candidacy. Only those that had gone through the process, regardless of whether they were judged not qualified, qualified, or well qualified, and there are three ratings, would be under the law allowed to file an affidavit of candidacy. In paragraph B, the consequences of the actual election itself. So, if a majority of people, voters, vote to retain the judge, then they will serve another. It's a 6-year term, just like it is now. Another 6-year term, beginning the first Monday in January, following the election in in November in the general election. It's only done in the general election. There are no special elections. General election, and then they either retain their office, they retain their office at that point, or if they are, if the voters vote no and vote that person out of office, then a vacancy is automatically created, and the process begins for the judicial, the merit selection process, which is within a period of 60 days, the Judicial Selection Commission must forward to the governor 3 to 5 names of potential candidates for that office, and the governor must select a person in to fill that vacancy. What is not permitted under this system is for a judge or justice who loses in the election, who is not retained, is not eligible to be appointed to that same office following losing a retention election. In Section 10, also looks to 480B and does not pertain just to judges at that point. Section 11 is now also in 480B, which is a selection commission that currently exists. And I think that it really does speak to the, once again, the honor in which we hold judges and those appointed to judgeships throughout Minnesota, that we're not coming up with in this proposal a new commission. We're just giving them added responsibilities, added added duties, and added, if you will, I think, an added right. That is, that they would be proposing to the governor a list of 3 to 5 names from whom the governor would choose, would point someone into a judgeship for a period of time before they also would stand for a retention election. And it would include district court judges, the workers' compensation court, as well as the appellate courts. Currently, the commission, in terms of an expansion of its duties and privileges, only does that job for the governor. And again, it's discretionary on the part of the governor whether he abides by their deliberations. But it does not deal with the appellate courts. Only the district court and the workers' compensation Court of Appeals. Under the system voting for retention, all judges and justices would come under the Merit Selection Commission that makes these recommendations among a group of, limited group of nominees. In fact, that's what they really are. They're a nomination commission, and the governor is the one who chooses them. I would also note that in 480B, and I think it is subdivision 11, that the which is not changed in this proposal, that the members of the nomination commission, the merit selection commission, are required to consider specifically women and minorities in the nominees that they forward to the governor, and that is I guess it's not subdivision 11, but it is in the that section of law, because in section 12 of this bill, which references subdivision 11, is is the duty and obligation of the commission to forward the names to the to the governor. And I would note that at 6.22, the second word there, committee, is deleted and commission is inserted. Everywhere else in 480B, the word commission is used, so that whatever that was, it was a technical thing that's never been corrected, and it is corrected in this bill. Section 12, again, requires the governor to choose among the nominees that come from the that come from the Judicial Selection and Nomination Commission. The Judicial Retention Elections, then, I'm looking now at on top of page 7, have to be conducted consistent with procedures for the administration of a state general election. So in a sense, that is instruction to the Secretary of State. And they are placed on the ballot, again, with regard to the section of the law, the chapter of the law, 204. Is that right? 204D.30, which is actually a new section of the law in that chapter that covers the retention of justices and judges. Then, beginning with Section 14, is the Performance Evaluation Commission's duties and procedures and standards that it must follow. So in Subdivision 1, the Judicial Performance Evaluation Commission is established. It is an independent body. It's not subject to the direct control of any branch of government. It's independent of them. What are their duties? First of all, after public hearings, the commission is required to adopt and administer a process for evaluating judicial performance. I might add, too, that the effective date of this bill, if the constitutional amendment is approved, is not until the middle of the year, July 1 of 2015, once again to allow for transition and to get this new system started up. Meanwhile, because of the transition that's in the Section 2 of Article Section 3, Section 3 of Article 1, judges would continue in office until this system was fully could be fully implemented. So their duty then is to have a process to produce a process that's designed to assist voters in evaluating the performance of judges that are up for retention, that facilitates self-improvement of all justices and judges. Now, why do we have that? Well, midway through this six-year term, as close as practical, there is a midterm evaluation process that's undertaken by the Performance Evaluation Commission. It's a time in which a judge's performance in that period can be reviewed, and if there are things that that particular judge could improve on, let's say maybe that judge or justice is like me. I am late to everything. That is not something we necessarily hold legislators to as a mark of their performance, but we do expect efficiency in the court system, and punctuality is a quality that we want to encourage in justice, in judges, out of respect to the people that appear before them, et cetera. So that could be something that they find that a judge or justice is not necessarily up to par in, and recommend some sort of self-improvement of you got to get to court on time, or at least when you say you'll be there.
Senator Rest, I appreciate your really thorough explanation of every section, but just keeping in mind that we have a long list of testifiers.
Yes, I'm almost
and then
finished.
Two different bills after that.
But I want people to know exactly what's in the bill and not think that things that are not in the bill are in it. And I'll be try to be briefer, but I'm trying to explain or maybe head off questions that might come later. The appointment of commission members, there are 24 commission members. 8 are appointed by the governor, 8 by the Supreme Court, and 8 by the legislature. And the they're from the governor's from the Supreme Court, only 3 members. A maximum of 3 members may be attorneys. From the governor's appointees, a maximum of 4, and of the legislature, a maximum of 4. What that ends up being
Senator
is that
Rest,
only 11 members can be attorneys.
You
a majority of
You just
transpose
that, actually. You just transpose that, but we can, it
okay,
says
I'm
for
sorry.
The Supreme
anyway,
Court, it's 4.
I'm trying to hurry now. At any rate, there cannot be a majority of attorneys that serve on the Judicial Performance Evaluation Commission, and with regard to particularly with the appointments by the legislature, and all 3 bodies, the Supreme Court and the governor and the legislature, are encouraged to consult with one another to make sure that the appointees reflect the diversity of our culture and demographics. In paragraph D, I point out that they are members are constrained by Chapter 10A, which is the conflicts of interest statute with regard to the campaign finance law. And in if you look down at subdivision 4, the Performance Evaluation Commission is subject to Chapter 13D, which is the open meeting law. The in subdivision 5 are the standards that are set against which a judge must be evaluated, and they include knowledge of the law and legal procedure, integrity, impartiality, temperament, respect for litigants, respect for the rule of law, administrative skill, punctuality, and communication skills. During the period of evaluation, there are surveys that are undertaken. There is a midterm evaluation that the results of which, because it is a midterm one, are not made available to the public. They are made available to the judge. Voters should come to a retention election with the final evaluation of the 6-year period of that judge. In paragraph B on and page 10, the evaluation, again, in the name of transparency and openness, must include a public hearing. There are among the people that, or the process involves a small panel of members of the full commission. It's 24 that is that does the initial final evaluation. It must include at least one appointee, one member who is an appointee of each of the 3 branches, and then others and chosen, and 5 chosen at random. And people who are on that must recuse themselves if they have a conflict of interest from serving, and then another person is placed on that panel. The panel then does the initial evaluation and forms and forwards their recommendation to the full commission. If the panel decides that judge or justice is unqualified, there's an automatic review by the full commission. If the panel decides in its evaluation that the judge is either qualified or fully qualified or well qualified, the commission, under its own rules, can either accept that without further action, or under certain circumstances, they can require that the review be done by the full commission, and that would always happen in the case that a panel would ask would have an unqualified rating. If it did go, whatever went to the full commission, if there was a tie vote, because there's only there is 24, the commission evaluation commission would be required to, within a period of 7 to 14 days, meet again and reconsider their designation of that particular judge or justice. If 7 to 14 days later when they meet, if they if there's still a tie, then the designation of the rating by the 3 to 5 or the 5-member panel would be the one that would prevail. There is a call in Subdivision 10 on page 11 for the publication of the evaluation results. Subdivision 11 is a different approach to an appropriation or the way in which the performance evaluations activities would be funded, and it is a statutorily dedicated fund within that comes from the general fund. And we had spoken with Senator Cohen and for some history over whether that's been done before, a dedicated fund coming out of the general fund. And the response I believe we got is that it's unusual but not unheard of. And then Section 15 are just the how you get going, and Section 16 is the replacement or instructions to the reviser, and then the two repealers are on page 12, and then the effective date, it would be July 1 of 2015 if the constitutional question was approved. Please keep in mind that the constitutional question is decided by the legislature, but this bill, if it was passed, would still nevertheless go to the governor, and he could veto or sign the statutory provisions. In addition, by holding it off to July 1st of 2015, the legislature could also make changes during the 2015 session to the statutory provisions. So, Madam Chair, that is the bill, and I'll step aside for the testifiers.
Are there any questions for Senator Rest before we proceed to the testifiers? And testifiers, because we're on a somewhat of a tight timeline, if you could please narrow your remarks to issues that have not been addressed beforehand as much as possible, we would appreciate it.
And Madam Chair, if I step away, maybe you could call them up at three at a time or something if you want to, so that we could proceed quickly. And I'm sorry I took so much time.
Great. Thank you. The first people listed are Sarah Walker, Justice Magnuson, and Judge Person. Ms. Walker, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Sarah Walker, and I'm here in the capacity as volunteer president for the Coalition for Impartial Justice. And thank you so much, Madam Chair, for having us today. Given the time, I will be extraordinarily brief. I just want to say, so I am here representing the Coalition for Impartial Justice, and this coalition is truly unique in its diversity of membership. It is one of the only coalitions where you're going to have the Minnesota AFL-CIO and the Minnesota Chamber working together, but that's only a portion of the diversity that's being represented. And this group has come together, despite many differences in other arenas, for three reasons, problems that they have identified. And they really want to address the impartiality, the accountability, and the information that's lacking in our current judicial selection process. And the first thing is, and as a citizen and a non-attorney, one of the things that I hear every election day is that who are these judges we're voting for? So the first thing this bill will solve is it actually provides information to the average citizen who, when they're going to the ballot. Most individuals we talk to are very tired of turning over the ballot and not having any idea who they're voting for when they are up for judge. The second thing that it's going to do is actually ensure accountability 100% of the time when someone goes to the ballot box through the system of retention elections, which Senator Rest nicely laid out. Right now, over 90% of judges run unopposed. So even if you did have information about that judge, you're not going to have an ability to hold that judge accountable if, in fact, there is some bad apple. The last thing it does is institute formally the system of mandatory merit selection. And this is something that has a long storied history in Minnesota, and that has been one of the reasons we have such a successful judiciary. And we strongly support this. We believe the time is now to actually move this forward. All you have to do is look around the country to our neighbors in Wisconsin, other Midwest states like Wisconsin, and see that high cost partisan judicial elections are sweeping the country, and it's not that far off in Minnesota. So the Coalition for Impartial Justice and its many partners are urging you to take action today. And the last thing I'll say is that we actually have appreciated working with the District Court Judges Association. The members of our coalition strongly support and believe that we have had a wonderful judiciary in Minnesota, and what we want to do is make sure that it stays that way for the good of Minnesota. So thank you.
Thank you. Justice Magnuson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here. The two questions that are most
asked. Excuse me, sir. Will you please state your name for the tape?
I'm sorry. For the record, Eric Magnuson. I'm a partner with the Robbins Kaplan Law Firm in Minneapolis.
Thank you.
The two questions that are most frequently asked when this topic comes up are why and why now? And the answers, I think, are pretty clear. When this state was formed and our Constitution was written, we had a system for election of judges. And to keep politics and partisanship out of judicial elections, because judges are different. You folks run on platforms. A judge can't run on a platform. A judge can't say, if you elect me, I will make sure that maximum sentences are imposed. That's antithetical to what a judge does. A judge decides cases based on the law and fact before him or her. Well, for 100 years or more, we had a code of judicial conduct that kept politics and partisanship out of judicial elections. And that was swept away by the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Republican Party versus White. The Supreme Court basically said, if you're going to elect judges, you have to let the candidates exercise all the free speech rights that every candidate has. Whether you agree with that or not, it is the law in this country. And what has happened as a result of that law is that we have seen increasing partisanship and spending to influence the outcome of judicial elections across the country. $13 million was spent on judicial elections in Michigan the last cycle, nearly $9 million in Wisconsin. Where does that money come from? It comes from campaign contributions. And if there is one thing that the citizens of this state don't want, it is a judiciary that they see as bought and paid for. If you have partisan contested elections, that is inevitable. The reason for this bill is to keep politics out of judicial elections as much as possible. It is also to provide voters with a meaningful choice when they go to the ballot box. They're finally going to get to vote for every single judge in the state of Minnesota. As things operate now, more than 90% of the judges never really face election. They're never really voted on by the voters because they don't have an opponent. Under this proposal, every judge must stand for election, must be evaluated, and must be acceptable to the voters. Why now? We haven't had the train wrecks that you've seen in other states, the campaign ads where someone shows a businessman who opens his suit coat and there's a little judge popping out of it because they've got the judge in their pocket. Well, it's naive to think that we are immune from that. Political forces, it's kind of like water. I've got a water problem at home now because of the ice. Water gets in. Political influence gets in. You'll never be able to keep it out completely. Even with retention elections, the three of the justices of the Iowa Supreme Court were voted out. But there's 10% of the spending in judicial elections where retention elections are involved. compared to contested elections. Why? Because while you may have incentive to get rid of a judge, under a retention election system, you can't pick the replacement. A merit selection picks the replacement. And I'll finish with this point. I chaired the Merit Selection Commission for 5 years. We have had, ever since Governor Al Quie started it, 30 years of merit selection in Minnesota. It is a process that, regardless of which political party controls government in this state, has served the state well. Why? Because the people who serve on that commission take their job seriously. I spent hundreds and hundreds of hours evaluating judicial candidates, not to find out if they were ideologically pure or would favor one side or the other, but to find out if they would take their oath seriously and do the good job that Minnesota judges do. I am absolutely convinced that the merit selection and judicial evaluation components of this bill will do nothing but enhance the high quality of justice in this state. The time to fix the roof is when it's not raining. If you wait until we have the train wreck that has happened in other states, you will have to then repair the public's confidence in the judiciary. I respectfully submit that as an independent branch of government, the judiciary deserves your protection. You should act on this, and you should act this session. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Person, welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you. I'm Carol Person. I'm a retired judge of district court. I was chambered in Duluth, and I served the counties of Cook, Lake, Carlton, and St. Louis. And I was on the bench long enough to know good arguments when I hear them, and I've just heard two excellent summaries of what I think this proposed legislation is all about. And I just soundly endorse the arguments that you've heard. When you step into a courtroom in Minnesota, you deserve to be assured that the person sitting on the bench is beholden to no special interest group, no person. You have the right to believe that there's a person of integrity and impartiality on the bench. This system, I believe, will continue and strengthen the proud history we have in Minnesota of an excellent bench. I was very proud to serve. My colleagues were excellent. But as the chief has pointed out, the forces that have come about are strengthening, and that impartiality that we've enjoyed is at risk. So I urge you to support Senate File 1082. I believe it's the right thing. It will help us continue to pick and retain excellent judges in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Person. Are there any questions? Thank you for your testimony today. The next testifiers on the list are Sherry Knuth, Phil Duran, and Judge Warner. If you could please approach the table. Ms. Knuth, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Sherry Knuth, Policy and Outreach Manager for League of Women Voters, Minnesota. Democracy requires trust and confidence. League of Women Voters supports integrity in all three branches of government, including the judicial branch. In 2007, the League of Women Voters, Minnesota convened a study committee to address the issue of judicial selection in Minnesota in light of the U.S. Supreme Court decisions that Justice Magnuson mentioned. Our concern was that the changes made by these federal court decisions threatened the quality and independence of our state judiciary. The legal system is based on the rule of law, and that means that decisions should not be based on personal views of judges, inappropriate public pressure, or moneyed or partisan interests. At the same time, judges need to be accountable to the law and the Constitution and to standards of diligence and competence. They should also afford fair treatment to all involved. How should these considerations be balanced in choosing judges? Based on our study committee's work, League of Women Voters adopted a position in 2008 supporting merit selection, evaluation of judges, and retention elections. This model is balanced. It guarantees qualified judges from the start while preserving the public's right to vote. It gives voters the final say on whether judges should be retained on the bench, and it provides voters with relevant, unbiased information before they vote. The League supports a judiciary that represents the diversity in our state and our communities, and research and data demonstrate that both women and minorities fare better and well in a system of merit selection. For instance, 2008 data revealed that 58.6% of women judges nationwide had reached the bench through merit selection or appointment, while only 34.7% had reached the bench through contested elections. League of Women Voters believes that the merit selection retention system is the fairest of the options available and best promotes public confidence in the courts. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Duran, please state your name for the tape.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Phil Duran. I'm the president of the Minnesota State Bar Association. Formed in 1883, the MSBA has some 16,000 members throughout the state. Most of us, of course, are lawyers, but we also have members who are law students, who are judges, or who are other legal professionals. As lawyers, we deeply appreciate the need for a judiciary that is and is seen to be impartial, independent, and nonpartisan. We've been a member of the Coalition for Impartial Justice for a number of years, and so this subject has been on our agenda for a number of years. I've had a number of opportunities to go and talk to people, both lawyers and non-lawyers, throughout the state. And I come away with a conviction that no matter what a person's partisan background, we agree that while there is a time and a place for party politics, the judiciary is not that time, that place. When we think of our clients, who are individuals, corporations, and organizations throughout Minnesota, few to none of them want their important legal matters decided by judges whose rulings are believed to be driven by partisan affiliation or affected by large campaign contributions in the previous election, rather than on the facts and law before them. We're convinced that the Impartial Justice Act strengthens Minnesota's commitment to merit selection of judges at all levels of the judiciary. As lawyers, we're concerned about what is going on in other states, particularly places like Wisconsin or West Virginia, where it appears that seats on the bench are seemingly sold to the highest bidder, or campaigns for judicial office degenerate into ugly partisan brawls. Our independent, nonpartisan, and impartial judiciary is an asset to the state of Minnesota, and it is worth preserving. We do not need to wait for a crisis to hit Minnesota before taking action to prevent the harm that's already been described. The first time a seat on the bench appears to have been bought or taken over by a political party, no matter which party we're talking about, the game's over, and it's the people of the state of Minnesota who will lose. I mentioned earlier that we have some 16,000 members across the state. It's my impression that approximately 15,900 of us get asked each November as elections approach, who are these people on the back of the ballot and what should we do? And while it may be interesting for us to provide our personal opinions, we think we can do better. We believe that the performance commission that this bill provides does a much better job of telling the voters in Minnesota who are the candidates worthy of retention. The MSBA strongly supports the Impartial Justice Act. We hope the legislature takes action this year. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Duran, I have a question for you. On the composition of the evaluation commission, as Senator Rest pointed out, each body can appoint 8 members, no more than 3 or 4 of whom may be attorneys. How do you feel about the limiting of some of those 8 members from each branch to being attorneys?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, as I said earlier, my conversations in the past several years have been with both lawyers and non-lawyers, and everybody seems to be, I think, on largely the same page here. When you look at the criteria that the bill sets out for what the retention commission, or the review commission, will actually look at the punctuality, the ability to administer the duties of the office, and so on. You don't need a specialized legal training to be able to establish whether this person treats litigants and their witnesses and so on in a fair and impartial manner. And so I think at the same time, we don't want it to seem like it's just a body of lawyers who are sitting amongst themselves talking and helping their friends. So I think achieving that balance is absolutely appropriate, and I don't believe the bar is concerned at all about the numbers that appear in this bill, and again, we do support the legislation.
Thank you. Any other questions? Judge Warner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Teresa Warner. I'm chair of the Minnesota District Judges Association's Elections Committee. I've been a district court judge in St. Paul, Ramsey County, the 2nd Judicial District, for 16 years. Currently, I serve as chief judge of the 2nd Judicial District. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota District Judges Association, or MDJA. I appreciate your patience with my comments. This is an important issue to the District Judges Association in the state of Minnesota, and I thank you again for the opportunity to be able to testify today. I want to acknowledge and thank Senator Rest for her work on the issue of judicial elections over the past many years. I know Senator Rest has spent much time listening to MDJA's thoughts and suggestions. We appreciate her work on this issue. As I begin these comments, I want Senator Rest, this committee, and the legislature, everyone here to know that the District Judges Association in the state of Minnesota will continue to work with you as this bill moves forward through the legislative process. Due to time constraints, I'm not going to go over the MDJA's position on judicial elections, except to say that we believe that a system must continue to ensure mandatory merit selection for all levels of judiciary. It must, if it includes popular elections, it must include must not include performance evaluations, and retention elections system must include a mechanism or trigger point for notice for a judge that a retention will be challenged, constitutionally created performance evaluation commission, the budget from a safe, secure, dedicated source of funding, and a system that applies to all judges and all courts. Currently, in its current version, Senate File 1082 addresses most but not all of the MDJA's concerns or points. Specifically, as it relates to the appropriation for the Judicial Performance Evaluation Commission, as introduced previously, this bill called for an increase in the annual attorney registration fee collected by the Supreme Court to fund the commission. MDJA supported that funding mechanism. The current version of the bill, we acknowledge attempts to provide statutory appropriation dedicated to fully fund the Judicial Performance Evaluation Commission. Again, we appreciate the work done by the author to accomplish MDJA's goal of having a budget for the Performance Evaluation Commission that is based on a source of sufficient, secure, and dedicated funding. However, in its current version, we've just begun to research it, and there has not been enough time to fully understand how the current approach will actually work. I remain confident, however, that we can find agreement on the exact statutory dedication language as this bill moves forward. The current version of the bill does not include a mechanism or trigger point that provides notice to a judge that their retention will be challenged. Now, I know there's been much consternation over the fact that the MDJA itself has not defined what a trigger point should be. I want to be clear on this issue. MDJA does not seek insulation from campaigns or contested judicial elections. The goal in seeking notice is to allow judges simply to do their jobs, making tough and sometimes controversial decisions, applying the laws of this state of Minnesota without retribution at the time of an election, whether it's retention or a general election. As you know, in a general election, there's a filing period, and there's notice at the deadline of that filing period who the opposition is. That does not exist in the current format for retention elections. As it relating to finance, I will just tell you that I know there was efforts to address trigger point by campaign financing. The MDJA supported, was much more comfortable at the $100 level than the $750 level, which is the current language. I understand there was campaign financing reform. This is a different election, so perhaps it doesn't apply. Just briefly, a couple of comments about the bill and its current status. This is our first impression. We're studying and researching just a couple issues. The bill previously talked about an 8-year term as opposed to a 6-year term. We are now looking at a 6-year term, which is the current status, but again, a retention system would change midterm evaluations. It would have a potential significant fiscal impact on the Performance Evaluation Commission. Again, MDJA supported or was more supportive of the 8-year term than the current 6-year term under the retention system. The proposed language of the constitutional amendment itself struck me personally when I read it as negative. It calls for restoring accountability to voters, and I much appreciated the comments that were made today about the quality of our judiciary. I believe strongly in the 300 and so judges that we have in the state of Minnesota, judges and justices who work hard. Ms. Walker referred to bad apples. You know, there is a process for addressing those bad apples. But the current amendment talks about restoring accountability to voters. I've been part of the MDJA's Elections Commission since 2008. I have met with Governor Quay, leadership and members of CIJ, members of the State Bar Association, legislators, and others, people of the members of the public about retention elections. All along, it's been represented that the state of Minnesota wants to maintain the quality of the judiciary and wants to maintain impartiality, accountability to the public, and fairness. This draft of this bill references that we need to restore accountability to the voters, such as that it's been lost. And this is, it was a surprise to me. Previous versions of the bill contained language that was much more appropriate in addressing the motivations for a retention system. So in closing, I appreciate, again, the work of Senator Rest, this committee, and in the addressing Senate File 1082. Most but not all of the requirements of a judicial selection method that preserves impartiality, provides accountability, and is fair to all stakeholders is included in the bill. On MDJ's behalf, I want to finally note that we're ready, willing, and able to provide information and input necessary to meet these components and to maintain a fair and trustworthy judicial election system. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge Ward. I hope that you'll continue to, as you have a chance to review the language, to continue to work with Senator Rest. I know she's willing to do that.
Thank you.
The next people listed on the list of testifiers are Judge Jude, Andrea Rao, and Bon Clayton. If you could please come to the table and state your name for the record.
Madam Chair,
Judge Jude, members welcome of the to the committee.
This is an intimidating room from this angle. In any case, I appreciate the opportunity to testify briefly on the question before the senators today. I, for one, am somewhat fatigued by constitutional amendments, and I suspect the voters are as well. And in this case,
excuse me, Judge Jude, will you please state your name?
Okay, my name is Tad Jude. I represent the 10th Judicial District. I do not represent the District Judges Association. A number of members of the court have spoken to me and share my opinion, but I do not speak for the association. The 10th District takes in Washington County, of course, Anoka County, Sherburne County, Wright County, and then it goes up north, takes in four other counties. And there really isn't a compelling or substantial problem out there that we're throwing this constitutional amendment after. We haven't turned into Wisconsin or Michigan, And I don't want to turn into Iowa or Illinois. And that's the proposed answer here, to turn our judiciary into the Iowa or Illinois judiciary. I think we have an excellent Minnesota system. I don't consider this to be a particularly fair or impartial question. The title is Impartial Election of Judges, Requiring Merit Selection and Public Performance Evaluation of Judges. That's the title. And then if you read the question is, shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended to establish an independent public performance evaluation commission which would empower voters with nonpartisan information about the performance of justices and judges, restore accountability to voters through judicial retention elections, as well as enhance, protect, and ensure the quality, impartiality, and integrity of the courts by requiring merit selection of all judges and justices. You know, that looks to me like it's written for SAPs. You know, really, it's a very leading question to put on the ballot. And if you're really interested in a fair, unbiased, impartial judiciary, you should start with a question and what's on the ballot, what the voters are going to be seeing. This isn't a new idea. If you go back into the history of the state, both the Democrats and Republicans agreed in the wake of the Dred Scott decision back in 1858 that we needed an elected judiciary. We have the federal system, a Madisonian system, where you have three branches of government, the executive, legislative, and judicial, but we're all separate, we're all equal, we're all independent, and we each get our authority from the same source, from the public. And just hearing the description of the bill today, you're having a combination of administrative courts and Article VI constitutional courts that I think is real unusual. It's destroying the separation, the equality, the independence of the judiciary. I don't want to be a part of the Office of Administrative Hearings. That's not our charge. But you could easily do that. We're talking about workers' compensation courts here. That's not an elected court. But many of the provisions of this bill apply equally to the administrative courts as well as the elective courts. And that hasn't been the way we've set up our judiciary in Minnesota. We're, I think, tampering with that balance, the Madisonian balance. And it isn't so much to empower the legislature or the governor or the courts, it's to protect individual rights. And the people who come to our courts are ordinary people. These are people who have foreclosures. They have underage drinking. They have DWIs. They're ordinary citizen problems. And that's why I think the courts have treasured their connection to the public, to the ordinary citizen, and why I oppose retention-only elections. And that's what we're faced with today. I think you're going against a fair, impartial court system that's separate, equal, and independent of the legislature and of the governor. So that's why I urge you to vote against it.
Thank you. Ms. Rao, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Rao, and I'm here representing MCCL, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. MCCL began in 1968 as a small group of individuals who shared a common interest and a common goal. Today, with more than 70,000 families and over 200 chapters across the state, we continue to view the organization in much the same light as individuals gathered together in 1968 did, a group of concerned citizens who have come together to speak with one voice. At MCCL, we know that a few individuals at our state office is not what makes a difference, but it is the tens of thousands of like-minded individuals acting in concert who make that difference. The ability of these individuals to have a voice in the various branches of government, local, state, and federal, executive, legislative, and judicial, is a primary principle of our government. MCCL believes strongly in this principle, and it is the primary reason that we oppose the proposal to institute judicial retention elections in Minnesota. The reasons for our opposition include that we oppose the premise that citizens aren't qualified to vote for judges. We believe Minnesota citizens ought to have the right to vote for a particular judicial candidate, not just against them. We don't believe that judicial retention elections make for less political judicial elections. And we believe that judicial retention elections move the accountability of the judicial branch from the electorate to a small, unelected, unaccountable commission of political appointees. And for these reasons, we urge the legislature and the subcommittee today to reject this legislation. Thank you very much for considering our thoughts.
Ms. Rao, not being very familiar with your organization, do you encourage voters to vote for or against particular judges?
I would say, Madam Chair, members of the committee, on a very small scale. We have in our newsletter or something like that in the past, we have let people know of various judicial candidates' positions, but we have not engaged in any kind of massive effort.
Thank you. Mr. Clayton, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Bon Clayton from Chanhassen. I have two very brief points. I think I'm opposed to the amendment for two reasons, although I could go into a long list. I know you don't have time for a long list. Number one, I don't think the people of Minnesota really think that it's necessary to make a change. I think they're happy with the current system. Most people actually, frankly, don't know much about the current system. But if you scratch the surface a little bit, you would find that they are happy with elections. My own opinion, too, not speaking for anyone else, reading the newspaper, is that district court judges in Minnesota are not too dissatisfied with the system either. My second point is that the voters are fed up with amendments. 2012 was a big snafu for lots of voters. No matter how you feel about the amendments, people were upset about having two amendments on the ballot, and many people are still upset. The voters are not ready to have another amendment. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Rest, if you'd like to come back to the table.
Can you take more testimony?
Yes, I was going to ask that, but okay, sure, you're welcome to. If you could just please state your name for the tape.
Yeah, my name is Tim Kinley. I'm an advocate for judicial reform and accountability. I have a local cable TV show that addresses this area and also family law reform. It's live Thursday nights at 8 o'clock on Comcast Channel 15. It's also, you can Google my name, Tim Kinley, and Speechless, and the show will come up. A couple of the foundational principles that were being laid as to why we need this is the integrity of our judiciary is so great. Anyway, we need this change. And the statement was actually said, as I understood it, that nobody contests how great our judiciary is in Minnesota, one of the best in the nation. Well, I'm on record saying, no, we don't. We have an unchecked, unaccountable judiciary in Minnesota. And I have hundreds of examples of how our judiciary is corrupt. And yes, I am a disgruntled litigant, and I have a right to be disgruntled because of what took place. No findings of fact, no conclusions of law, all of a sudden in an order saying, I can't teach my kids the Bible.
Mr.
This
McKinley,
is about the bill.
Great.
Okay, this is about the bill, and it's laying a foundation. And they laid a foundation, and I get to too. And it's all right if somebody says something in favor of a bill and says something positive. I can give negative examples and negative things. It's part of our free speech.
Right. I was just going to encourage you to please speak about the bill before us.
I will speak before the bill like everybody else has, and I'm speaking against it like other people have spoken for it.
You're welcome to.
Okay. Well, it doesn't sound like that. Okay. I'm amazed here that Democrats want to take away democracy.
Mr. McKinley, we have not yet voted on the bill, so I would prefer that you, again, please keep your comments to the legislation before us.
I am. Okay. I please you would not interrupt me and quit harassing me. Okay. I can hear the chant of the people voting for this bill that are in favor of this bill. Let us vote so we can't vote. You know, and I will never give up my right to vote. I won't do it. Okay. So this a number of issues here. There shouldn't be a title to this constitutional amendment. I mean, the Supreme Court, if it was before them, they suggested it. According to what we see in the law here and the Constitution statutes, there shouldn't be a title for a constitutional amendment. So just leave it out. Let's see. The incumbent designation, I'm glad to see that go. It shouldn't be there now, and I appreciate those legislators that have pushed that. It creates bias one way or the other. It shouldn't be there anyway. I think part of the talk that's going on here is about honoring the courts and our great justice system. We've created almost a religious cult that our judiciary is above reproach. And it's not. And human nature is in every single organization, and it's more important to have accountability and our checks and balances be strengthened and a foundation laid on the checks and balances before we start this judicial oligarchy going, where the people have very, very, very little say. And we have right now a broader scope of what's going on in our judicial elections where people supposedly have a say, and we're going to narrow it down to a small group of people. That makes it more political rather than less, because it's only a small group of people, insiders, and the people have a whole lot less say. Well, I didn't know this was coming up until late last night. I will reserve my other comments for the hearing tomorrow on this bill. But I just want to say accountability is key. And we had a judge in Dakota County arrest, put out an oral warrant on an attorney in that courtroom where the judge, where some bailiffs came back and said, hey, this attorney took pictures in the courtroom before the court hearing. Judge issued an oral warrant, arrested that attorney. Approximately three hours later, that attorney was brought back into that courtroom in a wheelchair, in handcuffs, to defend her client without her glasses, without the court papers. And the judge has the audacity to say, I didn't know she was in handcuffs. You know, I mean, it's... The stories that are going on in our judiciary are huge. We don't have this great a judiciary. Work on the accountability first. Changing this law does not change the bought and paid for aspect of our judiciary. Matter of fact, with the smaller group of people, it'll be easier to buy and pay for a judicial spot. Instead of having to pay off the whole electorate, you only have to pay off this smaller group of people to get you chosen. And it does not take away any of the political activity, because the governor's going to be appointing people and the legislature's going to be appointing people to these commissions. It just doesn't do that. That was a great sales job that went on earlier today, and there's a whole other side to this. I just say, please vote no. Strengthen the accountability, the checks and balances. This legislature has a responsibility to provide checks and balances. 26 areas you have accountability and authority over the judiciary. Do your job. Have a hearing on what's going on in the courtroom so that the people really know what's happening with the judges. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McKinley. Is there anybody else? I'm sorry. Oh, Mr. Kinley. Sorry. Excuse me. Sir, please approach the table. And if you could please state your name for the record.
Bob. Pardon me. Bob Auden. I'm representing the Libertarian Party of Minnesota. We find this to be a very dangerous bill. The problem it seems to be correcting is that it's trying to assist voters because voters don't vote for judges. But when you go to the, how about it, the problem really is that our judges are appointed rather than elected, even though we have this so-called election. The governor appoints them midterm. The judges don't complete their term. And then when they come up for election at the next election cycle, we have the word incumbent on the ballot. And no lawyer wants to run against an incumbent because if they lose, there's going to be retribution. So that's why there's no one else on the ballot. And people really don't want to vote for these positions because they don't know anything about them. If the Minnesota Supreme Court would simply allow information to be given to the public, well, then this this could be remedied. And we know that this does work because in this last election cycle, where there was an actual open seat created, so there was no incumbent judge, we had about 25 people running for that slot. So you don't have just the one person running. You had a whole slew of people running. And people did know about these judges. They got out. They were able to talk about themselves to some extent. And that's good. That's a check and balance on the judiciary. Because we know that there are people out there, and since the Minnesota Supreme Court has lost cases concerning elections here in Minnesota at the U.S. Supreme Court, we know they're not particularly good at interpreting the Constitution. Otherwise, they would have lost these cases.
Mr. Oden, I'd encourage you, just as I did previous testifiers, to keep your comments directed to the bill, please.
Well, I am, because the Minnesota Supreme Court here is going to be helping to determine who the judges are going to be, how they're going to be evaluated. And they have a bias. I mean, judges are simply politicians in black robes. So they're going to be, among other politicians, determining exactly who we're going to have for judges. And, you know, if they don't like somebody's opinion, like say they know somebody's for the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, well, they're simply never going to be sitting on the courts. The court will be stacked. And they're going to give preferences, like say, to minorities. Well, minorities vote Democrat. So these people are going to be basically hold the opinions of the Democrat Party. And I certainly know that libertarians will never be included among minorities. The judicial performance evaluation, which has to be approved by the Minnesota Supreme Court, I mean, it's all subjective. What was it, being punctual? I mean, that's really laughable. Or the communication skills. The real problem is just simply is the Minnesota Supreme Court. If they would simply allow us to have free judicial elections in the state of Minnesota, then we would have voters that were informed. We would have people that would actually be voting on these positions. And I know that this amendment is being considered because the Minnesota Supreme Court has lost at the U.S. Supreme Court, and so they want to rectify that by passing this amendment so that it can go back to the old way of doing things where judges didn't have to run for re-election. They were appointed based on campaign contributions or whatever. It's all about power, money, and control. And I strongly urge the committee here to vote this amendment down.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Oden. Is there anybody else in the audience who cares to testify? Please state your name for the record, sir.
Madam Chairman, my name is Carl Hansen. I'm a lawyer in the state of Minnesota. I've been in good standing since 1988. Just a quick point on this bill. I would urge you, encourage you to not vote for this bill, 1082. I would echo some of the earlier comments, but just the one additional comment I would like to make is that the bill removes accountability by the citizens, and a retention election is not the same thing as an election, and you are all elected officials, and you know that when you have an opponent that the issues get vetted, and they get out there, and they get aired by the people and the populace. Okay, if you have a retention election, you're not going to have those opportunities. The citizens of the state who pay the taxes, they pay the taxes of the judges, they pay their salaries, right? They are the ones who appear before the judges to have their issues decided. They should not be taken away the right to vote for the judges with whom they're their servants. They work for them. And as a lawyer, I would just say there are good judges and there are bad judges. When you appear before a judge who's not a good judge, you should have the opportunity to run against that judge and to oppose them. This system is going to remove that whole opportunity. And so you're never going to know whether the public will never know. It'll be very difficult to remove a bad judge. You have a retention election. You can vote yes or no, but who's going to provide the funds? Who's going to provide the energy to challenge this judge and to get them removed from the bench? Only through an election where there is an opponent, an opposition, will that occur. So that's my only comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify? Senator Rest, if you could please provide any comments, and we'll stand for questions. Senator Kiffmeyer.
I thought you wanted to go ahead with Senator Rest. I was just going to make a mention, Madam Chair, that one of the comments today was how intimidating it is. I think for us as to be at the testimony table, I think a lot of us who may be here frequently or at the table can get kind of used to it. But for a regular citizen to find parking, drive down, take time off work, spend that time to come down here, it can feel very intimidating. And I know that we all make every effort we can to accommodate, especially individual citizens who may not be as certain about processes. We give them deference and latitude because of their being a regular citizen coming here and according them that. I know you try hard to do that, Madam Chair, but I just think, I just thought in light of that comment, it's easy for us to forget just how challenging that can be.
In light of what comment, Senator Kiffmeyer?
As I said, there was an earlier comment when a testifier sat down that it's kind of intimidating to be at the testimony table.
Right. Well stated. Thank you. Senator Rest.
Madam Chair and Senator Kempfmeyer, I certainly agree with you. And I think we are so privileged in this state that people do come who are citizens that are interested in promoting good public policy, whether they agree with a bill that's before us or not. and that they do take the time to come and express their opinions, and I, for one, appreciate it. Madam Chair, I have no further testimony, and I think the testimony and the has spoken for itself, and I appreciate the committee's indulgence for the lengthy explanation of what the bill is, so that we know what exactly is in the bill and what is not.
Senator Rest, could you? I have a question on the. A testifier brought up the ballot question itself. Could you comment, please, on the language, especially as it relates to restoring accountability and providing voters with nonpartisan information about their performance?
Well, to take the first question, the second question first, I think the work of the and the duties of the Performance Evaluation Commission is to provide a public report with their conclusions, and that would be available to and then it is available to the public. It must be published according to the guidelines that are currently in statute to do that. The question itself, I think, is one that we, you know, continually look at to make sure that the that it does indeed reflect what the voters are being asked to vote on. And I think the phrase accountability of the voters means that we need to take on more responsibility ourselves as voters, not as legislators, but as voters for. For the judiciary, and that we want to make it clear that although we all know that voting is a right that's guaranteed to us, that most of us also consider voting to be a privilege and a duty, and that we require of ourselves to be informed. And I think that's what that phrase is referring to. It's not referring to the judiciary. It's referring to us as voters and what our responsibilities are.
Thank you. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've just got a few very brief comments that I want to direct to the bill and to the constitutional amendment. Time is short. I'm not going to get into the statutory language of the bill, but I do want to direct some comments to the constitutional amendment question and to the title. I don't know that I have ever talked to anyone who is opposed to the impartiality of the judiciary and the fairness and equality of their decisions. And so with that in mind, I would invite you to first of all look at the original bill that was before us, and the one that I read last night before we got the delete all. And the question that is going to be submitted to the voters in that bill, where we're being asking them to change our Constitution, says, shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended to provide that all judges be appointed? Now, I think that's a fair question. I really do, because that is exactly what is being proposed. Right now, we elect our judges. That's what our Constitution says. And that question in the original bill talks about changing that to an appointment system. Now look at the question that is on the delete all amendment. And what that question says is, should the Constitution be amended to establish an independent public evaluation commission that would empower voters with nonpartisan information about the performance of judges, restore accountability? Again, that seems to presuppose that we don't have current accountability, as well as ensure the quality, impartiality, integrity of our courts by requiring the merit selection system. And I would submit to the members of this committee that the proponents of this bill would be far better served if you would propose a question to the voters for the state of Minnesota that is more fair and more balanced. Just by reading the question that is being proposed to be submitted to the voters, I don't think you can come to any question, any conclusion, other than it is an overt effort on the part of those who support this bill to sell the question to the voters of the state of Minnesota. Then I would invite you to turn to the title, which is contained at the top of page 2. And what it says is the title to this constitutional amendment is going to be Impartial Election of Judges Requiring a Merit Selection and Performance Evaluation. That is not, it does not contain the essence of what is being proposed. The essence of what is being proposed is to change our Constitution from voting for judges to a purely appointment system to get them on the bench in the first place. And nowhere in that proposed title is that essence captured. And it is, again, an effort to sell the constitutional amendment to the voters prior to them knowing anything about it. I think it is both the question and the title to the amendment is grossly unfair and grossly misleading. And I really think that the proponents of the bill, if you want to go forward with this, would be much better served if you would phrase the question and the title to the constitutional amendment in a much more fair and impartial manner. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
Just with regard to the person previously spoke as well about the title. Chapter 204D.15, constitutional amendments are required to have a title. The issue in 2012 was whether the legislature had the prerogative or the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State claimed that he did. The court sided with the legislature, and the titles that were set forward by the legislature were the ones that appeared on the ballot.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Well, Madam Chair, the issue here is not does the legislature have the authority, but what is the language of the title. And that is the prerogative of us as legislators,
right,
to debate, to discuss, and to, yes, determine that. And so it's not authority. That's the question. We understand that.
No, no. Senator Kiffmeyer,
Senator
agree
Rest,
with you.
Please let Senator,
yeah,
Kiffmeyer finish.
I agree with you, though.
Oh, sorry. Were you done, Senator Kiffmeyer?
We'll leave it.
Is there any other discussion on Senate File 10?
Madam Chair.
Senator Liver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know how long we've been actually debating this issue. I've certainly heard it over many years. Certainly the public campaign for this has waged.
Madam Chair, I apologize. That's my phone. I hadn't turned it off.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Newman.
I just wanted to make sure people didn't think it was mine.
In no way would I think that was yours.
Senator Limmer.
I think that was planned, ma'am.
My apologies, Senator Limmer.
Right, it was my brother, so yes, we had a signal.
Madam Chair, this discussion has been involved in the public for quite some time. The proponents have gone to numerous Chamber of Commerce meetings, breakfasts. Rotarian clubs have heard their pitch about it, and yet at the very same time, I have, and they've done it in my community, I have not heard or seen a wave of people coming and battering down my door to say, we want to get rid of our vote and give it to political appointees to select judges. I just have not heard that. And as I review this bill, the question itself that would be on the ballot, to me, is patently biased. It leads the voter to conclusions. That type of question should not be a part of any ballot. It's plain and simple. It should be fairly stated, not leading, not assuming that there's no accountability in our judicial system, restoring accountability. That is just false. Looking at other things, empowering voters. Well, the voters aren't going to have the same rights that they have if this provision is passed, because they won't have an opportunity to select a judge between one or two choices. This isn't empowering the voter. This is just simply giving them one half of a conclusion based on political appointees making a labeling effect on someone on the judiciary or seeking a judicial appointment. I was looking at how the merit selection label is referred to in this bill, as if we don't have merit selection. We have merit selection as required by our statute, and it's been used for many years, all the way since Al Quie's gubernatorial reign in Minnesota. And yet, at the same time, I keep hearing things about the proponents. I've heard some, even from the, it's been reported to me, that even Al Quie had made mention that the collection for this type of campaign has already begun, and they have an excess of $2 to $3 million already in a war chest, already for deposit into a campaign fund of some sort. I hope we consider, when we consider any constitutional amendment, the fairness to the voter of whether or not each side is equally prepared to defend or purport their views on a particular constitutional amendment, depending on whether one has resources and one does not, let alone an organization. I know we've talked about it for a long time. The public has not talked about it a long time. I don't think there's any merit in going forward with this particular amendment, simply because I don't see the public pounding our doors down for this. And as far as the argument to avoid unnecessary influence on our judicial elections, I haven't seen that either. I think we've talked about this for 8 to 10 years. The boogeyman is still being talked about, but there's been absolutely no proof that there's undue millions and millions of dollars spent to put a particular judge in office over someone else. That just has not happened in Minnesota, and the proponents of this particular bill has not proven that necessary either. So we can be fearful of everything, but as far as the testifiers that were here, fearing that their vote would be taken away, their right to vote and select a judge would be taken away, they are absolutely correct. They will have their vote taken away, and this half measure of approving someone else's judgment would be in its place, which I think is by far a seriously discounted role of a citizen.
Madam Chair, just a clarification. The merit selection process is not being done away with. Indeed, two things happen to it. It is made mandatory, and it is now extended to the justices of the Supreme Court and the Appeals Court.
At this time, we still have not adopted the A9 amendment. Right.
So Madam Chair, so I would renew my motion that the A9 amendment be adopted.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Oh. The chair is in doubt. All those in favor, please raise your hand. The motion does pass. Senator Rest, on the
Then I would move that the
bill
Senate file 1082 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the full committee.
I'm sorry, it's being referred to the Rules Committee.
The full committee, right, the full Rules Committee.
Mm-hmm. Is there any other discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion passes and the
Thank
bill
you,
is
Madam
referred
Chair.
To the Rules Committee. Thank you, Senator Rest.
Appreciate the time.
To the public, we do have two more bills on the agenda. The committee is supposed to end at 2:30. Senator Eakin, because we pushed your bill off last time, unless there's any objection from anybody here, we'll first hear Senate File 1778. And perhaps I'll just announce it now that we will move Senate File 1915. To a later date, and we'll provide notice as soon as possible.
I didn't want anybody
Mr. Knapp,
that was my purse.
I apologize for that. I believe he was sitting here for waiting to testify.
Do we hear your bill now?
Wait. Senator Rest? Senator Eakin, as you approach the table. Senator Eakin, if you could please begin discussing the bill.
Sure.
Senator Rest and Senator Cohen indicated that they'd like to come back for it.
Okay.
So, but if you could, we won't make any motions until they're back. But Senate File 1778, if you could please begin to discuss it.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1778 deals with conflict of interest issue and also with disclosure of financial interests, which apply to elected officials and appointed officials. And this bill simply adds spouses to the ones who have to disclose the financial information and also would be subject to conflict of interest. And having to comply with those laws. If you look on the first page, it says that the financial interests of the official's spouse, as well as the official themselves, would have to be included in disclosure of potential conflicts of interest and have to adhere to the same standards and same requirements as the elected official themselves. And also, it does add, as far as the issue of economic disclosure, it does say that the it does add one more addition here for both the elected officials and for the public officials and for the spouses. If you look at the third page where it says a listing of the business and professional activity codes from which the individual or spouse receives compensation of more than $50 in any month as a consultant or independent contractors. So consultants and independent contractors also would be included in the disclosure of these economic interests or financial interests. And as it says here, the business or professional codes reported under this clause must be those that are used by the Federal Internal Revenue Service. So that's the only thing that was added in this bill. And there is at the very beginning a provision which deals with audits and investigations, changing it from being permissive for the Campaign Finance Board to engage in audits and investigations to being mandatory if they see if there's any reason for it. This provision, however, I know there's an amendment in the packets that I believe Senator Rest was going to offer on that would eliminate that portion. But
Senator Rest.
I'm not offering it. You, am I? Is that?
Senator Rest, if you...
I'm offering the A1.
Right. Could please move the A1 amendment.
I move the A1 amendment.
Okay.
And members, as you will see, what it does is delete section 1 of the bill. Are there any questions? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The A1 is adopted. Senator Eakin, if you could please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I've already described basically what's in this bill, and it, I just feel that it is important that spouses also be included. Obviously, they also would be a direct beneficiary, not just the elected official or the public official that's in question here, but the person that they're married to as well, I think, should be included in the conflict of interest and economic disclosure provisions in our laws currently. And I really see it as an oversight. That's something that we really should have addressed long ago. So it's, I think it's something that most people would recognize as being a conflict of interest if spouses are not included. So,
thank you, Senator Eakin. Mr. Goldsmith, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. I'm here primarily to answer questions and provide any assistance that you might need. I will point out that this is not a bill that the Campaign Finance Board drafted or introduced. This is a bill by the authors, so my input to date has been solely to provide guidance to make sure that a bill results that can be administered. The version here in this body is slightly different than in the House because there were some changes made to the language to make it a little bit more clear what's intended. But the intent is the same, and that is to add spouses to the economic interest disclosure system. And then also for people who actually fell outside of that system, namely independent contractors, the public knew nothing about the sources of income of that group of people, and this bill would not require those people to disclose their clients, but rather simply to disclose the subject matters in which they provide service so that the public, the press, or other members of either body could then ask that official about those activities should a potential conflict of interest be found.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Senator Eakin, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can dispose of this issue very quickly and indicate to Senator Eakin I will not be able to support your bill. I will tell you that, frankly, I don't think your wife or mine is subject to the jurisdiction of the board unless they file for office. And I think your wife and mine could quite correctly tell the board to take a hike. We're not going to submit any of the financial interests information that is being sought. I just really don't see how we can force a spouse to comply with this statute. So consequently, I'm sorry, I won't be able to support your bill.
Madam Chair and Senator Newman, I respect your opinion on the matter. I just feel that obviously a spouse's financial interests, I think, do have an impact on the thinking of public officials and what positions they may take. And I think that the public has a right to know what influences there may be on their decision-making process, at the very least.
And if I may follow up, Senator Eakin, I think you're right. I think they do have an influence on us to a great extent. My question is, does the board have jurisdiction over them? It's a legal issue. And unless they file for public office, I do not believe they do.
Mr. Goldsmith, have you run into this question in other states or know of examples of other states to help answer that question?
Madam Chair, many other states do require spousal economic interest disclosure. Some do require children's economic interest disclosure as well. I will point out two things. First of all, that the Campaign Finance Board was deadlocked on this particular question. Three members supported this type of disclosure and three didn't, and that so we didn't have a recommendation as to which way to go, but rather we recommended the legislature look at it and make its own decision. I would point out, secondly, though, that the bill, as drafted, puts the burden on the public official to provide the disclosure. The board would not, in fact, have jurisdiction, as I read the bill, over the spouse of the public official. And the question was posed in the other body, what if a spouse simply refuses to provide that interest to the public official who is the spouse? And at this point, I don't have a clear answer to that, but the obligation would be on the public official to provide the disclosure, and we would have to work with the public officials to see where that's a problem and presumably come back to the legislature and let you know if it is, in fact, a problem.
Okay, thank you. Is there any, Senator Leonard?
Mr. Goldsmith, could you go over the independent contractor relationship again? An individual happens to, let's say an individual candidate happens to be a participating in a business where he has to deal with individual clients. Let's say an accountant or an insurance agent, a real estate agent, would, according to this bill, would they have to disclose every single customer that they deal with?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Let me just turn to the section, Madam Chair. They would not disclose, in any case, customers. They would disclose business codes for customers. So if they had a customer, for example, that was an architectural firm and they were providing financial services to an architectural firm, they would disclose the category for architectural services. And it wouldn't matter how many clients they had in that area, they would disclose it only once. So there would be potentially a number of categories of services that they would provide, but never any client names.
All right. Sarah Limmer.
Yeah, Mr. Goldsmith, if, let's say, an individual candidate or incumbent was working for a company that was a major principal in lobbying in state government, would they have to disclose that?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Perhaps they have to disclose that now, I would imagine.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, that's correct. That would not fall under the new provisions. That would simply be an employment that would be disclosed under current law.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair and Senator Eakin, I am going to support your bill, but I do share some of the same kind of sense of umbrage at requiring a spouse, or like in other states, requiring a children also to disclose. But I do know it's a widespread practice, and that across the country, and certainly is looked at the federal level for spouses, for example, who are lobbyists, and how you know, there's this bright line or brick wall with regard to that. And I know Minnesota is not highly regarded with regard, you know, referencing economic interests of legislators, but I do. I continue to find it troubling, quite frankly. But I at least you're not going for the children and aunts and uncles and next-door neighbors and stuff. But so I'm going to vote for it, but I want you to know that I too have some misgivings that this actually leads to more transparency with regard to the influence on legislators as they and other public officials as they make their decisions.
Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on Senate File 1778? Seeing none, no one. Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 1778 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Rules Committee. Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye.